When you hear the word Disney, what's the first image that comes to mind? Mickey Mouse? Maybe a baby elephant with oversized ears who can fly? A red-headed mermaid or a blue genie with a wicked sense of humor? When we think of Disney, we think of state-of-the-art animation. But believe it or not, 25 years ago, it seemed like the company might scrap its animation division altogether. A new documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty, directed by Don Hahn and produced by Peter Schneider, offers an inside look at the struggles and revival at Disney Animation between 1984 and 1994. During his 17 years at Disney, Peter Schneider was responsible for the creation of 50 films, including Little Mermaid and Toy Story. He also won Tony for producing The Lion King on Broadway. Don Hahn produced some of Disney's most successful films of the period, including Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King. Waking Sleeping Beauty, this film, opens today at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema, and I'm very pleased that it brings Don Hahn and Peter Schneider to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Hi there.
So, Don, when did you first start working for Disney?
Well, back in 1976, when a lot of the animators who worked with Walt Disney were still at the studio. So it was great. I would take them coffee and learn about just about everything about the animation craft.
And how long before they started leaving, replaced by others?
Well, really within the next 5 years or so. I mean, I was part of a class of people that included people like Tim Burton and John Lasseter. And there was this big generation gap. So you had guys in their 60s at the end of their career and guys in their 20s at the beginning of their career. And I think that's part of the tensions that set up this time in this film.
What about changes in technology? Was this a period where when people stopped using cells and started doing other things?
No, not yet. I think the standard technology was a 79-cent pencil and some paper, and it wasn't until really after 1984 that the technology started to creep in a big way.
Peter, someone says in the film that animators used to ask each other, what would Walt do? And if it was determined an idea didn't fit with their ideas of what Walt Disney would have done, it would be scrapped. What's an example of an idea that was thrown out on that premise?
Well, you know, that's the extraordinary thing about this is when I got there, people always said, this is not what Walt would do. And what I discovered, this is not the way Walt did it, was their standard answer to me as a newcomer to this business in 1985. And after a while, I realized that they weren't alive when Walt had been there. So how did they know what Walt would have done?
But there were people who were. I know I interviewed one of the animators who'd come from, I think, working on Betty Boop cartoons to doing the High Host sequence in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And he said that Walt insisted that everything jiggle in every frame. So that when the dwarfs walk...
You know, those are words to live by.
I want everything
their
jiggle.
Hats jiggle, yeah. Their eyebrows move, their eyes moved.
Yeah.
It wasn't... And the leaves all moved as they walked by. And that was a big difference. Betty Boop, they would just set up some kind of background and she would wiggle a bit.
Correct. I mean, I think what you discover from Walt really left us with a legacy of tell a great story, tell it with great characters, and push the technology boundaries one step forward. And I think that's the thing I inherited or learned from the reading about Walt.
Well, we've been talking about the animators going through a change. What about the people who were running Disney?
Well, the same way, too. I suppose before 1984, it was a family-run company, and it really was. There was a Disney in the chairmanship for, you know, 50 years or so.
And Roy came back at one point.
And Roy came back, and yet in 84, he resigned from the board, which is a big deal. And Ron Miller, who is Walt's son-in-law, resigned from the company at the same time. And I suppose it's the biggest kind of earthquake that happened during that time is Roy brought in Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg and Frank Wells, which was so unusual for that family-run company. And now Hollywood is there within the walls of that studio.
But did any of them have any background in animation?
I would say none. I mean, Michael programmed a little animation for ABC when he worked there as a younger man in New York, but he really didn't. And I'm not sure they cared all that much about feature animation. It wasn't a big money maker. It cost a lot of money to make the films. And the films were pleasant little films that came out every 4 years. It wasn't a big business for the company.
I think it was Roy who really put his body in front of them and said, leave animation alone. It's mine. I will show you how it's done. And over a course of 5 or 6 years, everybody became very interested, A, because of the artistic success, but also the commercial success. But it was really Roy who said, this is mine.
Now, what happened? We went from it being an expensive way to make movies that didn't do all that well to still some of the biggest box office successes of our time, and now especially with 3D being introduced.
Well, I think that's what we tried to chronicle in this movie, is why did it happen? What were these steps? Who were the people? What serendipitous? What luck happened?
Yeah, because it wasn't planned.
I wish
I could say, oh, we were really smart and we planned it all, but boy, that wasn't the truth. And we say in the movie, it was kind of a perfect storm of people and circumstances, and the VCR came in at that period, so suddenly the whole vault was being emptied quickly onto videotape, and there was a real vacuum, and people needed that entertainment. So suddenly you're making one movie a year with some of the best talent on earth.
But didn't video also, which Disney controlled, they were more limited in their release schedules than other companies. Didn't that bring an infusion of money?
Infusion of money.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Then again, I think part of what...
Because people wanted this for their kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then again, what you were seeing was that money being reinvested back into the artists. And that what really made this period special were these extraordinary artists who came of age during this 10-year period of time. Glenn Keane, John Musker, Ron Clemens.
And we lucked across one gentleman, Howard Ashman, who had a Broadway hit kind of crash and burn and wanted to go to Los Angeles to escape a little bit, and ended up writing all the music for Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin.
Along with his writing partner, Alan Menken, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Howard Ashman who really was the lyricist and the storyteller. And we try to celebrate that he died in this period of time, 1991, but his influence was extraordinary.
Wasn't Beauty and the Beast the first movie to use digital animation? In the brief ballroom scene?
It wasn't the first. We used a little bit of it in a movie called Great Mouse Detective that preceded it, and some other smaller uses, but it was probably the most memorable because that ballroom scene was, breathtaking for the audiences of that time anyway, and a little bit ahead of its time. Now we're so used to it with Pixar movies, and we see it every day, but it was a first.
So what am I to make of the fact that Disney's latest animated feature, The Princess and the Frog, notable also for having its first African-American heroine, didn't use computer animation. They returned to the old-fashioned hand-drawn animation.
You know, I think there's lots of techniques out there. Don's making a movie with Tim Burton, Frankenweenie, and stop motion. John and Ron did this movie in pencil, and John Lasseter does computers, and Secret of Kells does it with different techniques.
Yeah, and Avatar does it with different techniques. So it's more about
that's
choosing
just Photoshop.
Yeah.
Well, I know. I think it's much more than that.
That's another 3-hour show. but it's really about choosing the technique that's right for the film. So I think it's great. I mean, the fact that you can say this movie is better told with the pencil and paper and paint as opposed to pixels and phosphor and that kind of thing is an artistic choice. And I think that's what makes it interesting.
And audiences go for a great story.
I'm talking to Don Hahn and Peter Schneider. Their film, Waking Sleeping Beauty, opens today at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema. One element of the documentary that was really fun to see was the caricatures that the animators made, mostly of their bosses.
Mostly of Peter, actually.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
How did it feel to be caricatured by those guys?
You know, on every April 1, April Fool's Day, there was a caricature show. And you were scared to death to go into the hallway to see how you're going to be lampooned or taken fun of.
It was brutal.
It was brutal. But worse than that was not being there. At least if you were there, you knew they sort of liked you, even though they were vicious and it was kind of mean at times. But if you weren't there, then you weren't thought of.
Now, much of this story is not just about changing techniques, but about the politics of the studio. And at a time when other people came along and were also doing animation and sometimes doing it much more successfully than Disney, a lot of old rivalries took place. How did you deal with that? And because, Peter, you said you're friends with Michael Eisner. He's in some people's books, he's one of the villains of this story, isn't he?
You know, for me, there were no villains during this 10-year period of time. Some very clever, very smart, flawed human beings, myself included, but Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Roy Disney, the artists. It was an extraordinary creative period of time with a lot of tension. And we try to figure out why that tension was there. Where did it come from? We try and tell it warts and all in this movie. It's not a sort of puff piece about, oh, how great we were. It's not that. It is about dealing with the politics of how do you interact with these very powerful people.
Yeah. For example, Jeffrey Katzenberg resigns after The Lion King comes out.
Yeah.
There's a huge hit, and he's largely responsible for its success.
That was a really odd time. In a 4-month period, you have the Northridge earthquake that kind of wiped out the studio, and suddenly Lion King's being made on kitchen tables and in garages, and then you have Frank Wells passing in a helicopter accident, and Michael Eisner getting a heart attack, and Jeffrey leaving, and it's this amazing chapter turn in the history of Disney. And that's how our story ends. And I think that the main thing we want to do is humanize these people. A lot of times you see the word Disney and you think of it as a very glossy brand, which I suppose it is. But to actually look behind the scenes a little bit and say, you know, we're guys that put our pants on one leg at a time and we're human beings.
But it looked like chaos for a while. It's the reason that there was a campaign to bring Roy Disney back to the studio.
Yeah, well...
Didn't he ultimately win all of this power struggle?
In the end, Michael left the studio towards the end of his contract, probably a little prematurely. But I think that's the nature of these gentlemen. You know, a lot of times Hollywood is high school with money. And I think with these guys, a lot of the same things. And seldom about money, but about relationships and ego and who takes the credit and, who's protecting who. And I think those kinds of struggles between individuals is what makes the human experience, whether you're at an animation studio or not.
Well, Michael Eisner has done very well since, and so has Jeffrey Katzenbach. So
they've all done really well. I mean, Jeffrey's produced more animated movies than any single individual.
Yeah, more than Walt Disney.
And some great things. And Michael, again, is being very successful in the internet and in media. So it's fun to look back at this period of time, both creatively, but it's also fun to reconnect with the human emotions. Like, we are all 5 years old. We never get beyond being 5 years old in the sandbox.
Why do you think Jeffrey Katzenberg decided to hold animation meetings at 6 a.m.? Because he couldn't sleep?
There's so many answers to that, but I think the real answer is anyone else in Hollywood wouldn't show up until 10, and he knew the animators had something to prove. And we religiously and happily showed up because we got uninterrupted time with Jeffrey. And let's face it, Jeffrey was a great editor. He was a great companion, a great partner to us. And as tough as he could be at sometimes, he pushed us really, really hard to do our best work. So, it was early, but we made it.
What about the connection to Broadway? There was it seems at a certain point, I guess with the success of Lion King, that Disney was thinking, how can we do a film that could be adapted to a Broadway play?
You know, it's the other way around, really, because Beauty and the Beast, when it came out as a movie, Frank Rich, I believe on this network, said in his online review, or KQXR, boy, this is the best Broadway musical to open this year, and he was talking about the film. And from that particular statement of Frank's, we went off and made the Broadway show, and then came along Lion King, which of course transformed Broadway in some sense.
One of the changes that I had noted was that I remember when I was a kid, and the Disney films would come on, and we'd all go ugh. But when Bugs Bunny came on, or Woody Woodpecker, we were all excited.
We're not insulted at all by that.
Well, I mean, it was a long time ago.
Okay,
I'm very old.
Thank you.
But the later films seem to be taking adult audiences, keeping them in mind, and we see sarcasm and all sorts of things there that we would not have seen in Dumbo.
Sadly, you are correct, and I think I probably felt the same way. I grew up with Jay Ward cartoons and Rocky and Bullwinkle. For me, it was probably Roger Rabbit that turned that corner, because that was a Disney Amblin film, but it had all these characters from Tex Avery and Bob Clampett and Chuck Jones, and suddenly you go, I really love animation. Where has this animation been? And I think that helped us turn a corner and bring people, not just kids, but adults back to the theater again.
It also inspired the animators to do their best work on Little Mermaid and Roger and Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, yeah.
The theme linking the breakthrough movies you cover in your documentary, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, seem to be a protagonist who aspires to be something greater than him or herself. Do you think that was a key to their success? Were people sitting around and saying, hey, what can we do now about an aspirant hero?
They are aspirational movies. You hit it on the head. Whether you are a kid or an adult, you go to see these movies, and they are meant to be inspiring. It's a hero against all odds trying to overcome those things. And that's what we love. We love to have the lights go down and suspend our disbelief and be transported away to another world.
And how come Hercules didn't work that way?
I don't know. I thought Hercules worked pretty well, actually.
It didn't do well in the box office, did it?
You know, it didn't do as well as The Lion King, but I'm not sure anything ever will do as well as The Lion King.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime movie.
$350 million. It's pretty hard to top, and to judge your life against that, it's not. You can't be successful.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. Peter Schneider, Don Hahn, whose film Waking Sleeping Beauty opens today at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Same here. Thank you.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, Sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre. Why, we only live to serve. Try the gray stuff. It's delicious. Don't believe me? Ask the dishes. They can sing.